This is Spectator Radio, and you're listening to the Americano podcast with Freddie Gray.
Hello, and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics and the Trump presidency for the new Spectator USA website. I'm joined today by John Rick MacArthur, who is publisher of Harper's Magazine in New York, and we're going to be talking about the resignation slash firing of Ian Baruma, the editor of the New York Review of Books. So, Rick, just to start with, I'll just sort of lay out how I think the story works, and you can correct me if I'm getting it wrong. In the forthcoming edition of the New York Review of Books, Ian Baruma published a piece by Gian Gomeshi, who is a kind of Canadian celebrity, sort of Harvey Weinstein before Harvey Weinstein, if you like. He was accused of terrible sexual misdemeanors, was not convicted. And he wrote a piece about what it's like to be seen as a monster in the media. And it was a sort of, I thought, rather self-serving, whiny piece, but it, nonetheless quite an interesting read. Anyway, it caused a huge uproar. It has already caused a huge uproar, and it has already forced Ian Baruma to resign. Is that a fair summation of what's happened?
Yes, there's been a Twitter storm, a kind of trial by Twitter, which is what I refer to as extrajudicial justice, where Baruma has been ejected from his job as editor of New York Review because a mob decided that he's not fit to edit the New York Review because he published a piece by one of these awful, supposed allegedly awful male predators. Now, We published at Harper's Magazine, we're always first, I'm exaggerating, but we're ahead of them with a piece by John Hockenberry, who was another a national public radio personality and journalist in the United States, who is similarly accused of horrible predatory practices, except that Hockenberry is in a wheelchair. He's paraplegic. So I have been trying to remind people that this is a good example of proportion and disproportionate response to bad behavior, which both men admit to, that the lumping together of Harvey Weinstein with John Gomeshi or John Hockenberry is fundamentally crooked thinking and fundamentally unfair. But
You could also say it's unfair of Harvey Weinstein because he hasn't been tried yet.
Yeah, he hasn't been tried. He's innocent until proven guilty. However, there is a mob rule mentality now, which breaks down into different tendencies, let me say. One day I think it's Soviet. In fact, I accused the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation interviewer who interviewed me the other day about this of having a Soviet tone. In other words, they are demanding that these men not only confess to their crimes and disappear, but they have to recant in a kind of a public, perfect way, the way Soviet dissidents or Soviet somebody who wasn't hewing to the party line were forced to publicly humiliate themselves in front of the Central Committee. And I'm quite serious about this analogy because there's a ruthlessness and a humorlessness and a rigidity to the accusers, which is fundamentally un-American and anti-democratic. Now, it's also possible to make a comparison with McCarthyism because nobody's accusing Ian Baruma of being a sexual predator. They're only attacking him for associating with an alleged sexual predator. Remember, again, yes, he was acquitted of all the charges. So
being a predator sympathizer.
Right, he's a fellow traveler. He's both a fellow traveler and a communist sympathizer. So, I mean,
it is
extraordinary. So there's a McCarthyite element to it. There's a Soviet element to it. And there's also just a kind of mob rule, mass hysteria side.
There's another interesting aspect which I'd like to ask you about, which is the targeting of people above the editor or who are in positions of power to kind of influence whether the editor stays or goes. I mean, I think in this instance, it seems there was pressure put through the advertisers, the university presses, who give a lot of money to the New York Review of Books.
Yes.
And it was became very clear that if he was to stay, then a lot of money would have been withheld, and so his position became untenable.
Yes.
And we see this a bit in Britain, where when you publish something, they don't go to the editor, they will go to the people above the editor and say, is this acceptable? And it's a sort of, it's almost an authoritarian culture in which people are informing on you on the highest possible authority.
Yeah, correct. And what's bizarre for me and kind of destabilizing is that I used to have to deal with this from major multinational corporations. I remember Pfizer Pharmaceutical canceled, to my horror, a $100,000 advertising schedule because we ran a piece criticizing their sleazy marketing of antidepressants. And the CEO was outraged, and they pulled the advertising. Well, that's the way it used to go. But at least you were dealing with something of I think, greater substance. What's happening here is the people who you associate with freedom of expression, freedom to publish, freedom to write, freedom to think differently, the university presses, apparently, according to Baruma, put pressure on New York Review, and New York Review caved. If New York Review caved in because of pressure from university presses, it not only puts the university presses in a very bad light, but it also puts New York Review and its owner in a very bad light. It is disgraceful if that's what happened. Really disgraceful. And we're all weaker for it.
And I suppose, Harper's is blessed, I suppose, as having you the publisher, because you're the person, the buck stops with you, right?
Right. And I'm not going to put up with this. I've been through much worse than this. And we published an excerpt from the Satanic Verses. We published the Danish satirical caricatures of Muhammad. We've done a lot of things that put us at risk, I think, physically. And so I'm a little bit alarmed to see my colleagues caving in so quickly to a Twitter mob, essentially, a kind of amorphous, decontextualized Twitter mob of people who are barely, in many cases, barely coherent. It's not a joke. I don't mean to be flippant about this, because it is a serious threat to freedom of expression and the ability to publish and write independently. And the Baruma resignation or firing, whatever it was, is a catastrophe for American democracy and freedom, I think.
And what do you think it is about these Twitter mobs, as you call them, that are so much more effective at getting things shut down or getting people fired?
Well,
what is it that makes them more effective than, let's say, corporations trying to stick up for their interests or whatever?
Well, I guess because it's so personal. If you read some of these things, and I think they take a page from Donald Trump, they've learned the techniques of internet Twitter savagery to some extent from Trump. He sets the example for the left as well as for the right. And so if you're an average writer and you're worried about your income, your future, whatever, or you're a publisher of modest means, you look at these personal attacks and the viciousness of them, and you say to yourself, my God, my whole raison d'etre is being called into question. It's not just an amorphous corporation taking money away from me. It's my whole sense of myself being attacked. And if everybody around you is also screaming at you, which I assume they were doing at New York Review, some people on the staff were obviously unhappy with the piece and were complaining about it, it becomes emotionally very difficult to hang in there. It's harder to make it a matter of principle. And some people just aren't up for it. They say, well, it's not worth it, and I give up.
There's also this strange thing that seems to be going on of it's often the most, let's call it lefty, left liberal publications that get the most anger. And because I suppose there's a sense of betrayal among young progressives that these publications are meddling in this stuff. I mean, so we have The Atlantic had their thing with Kevin Williamson, and there was an outrage about him and he was then fired. Then you had The New Yorker recently with Steve Bannon, who was invited to speak at something and then was disinvited because of complaints. You've had experience of it at Harper's as well. There's this, on the American left, there's this sort of purging thing going on, isn't there?
Yeah, although I don't consider the New Yorker and the Atlantic to be left-wing magazines. I consider them to be tools of the internet mob and of the, to some extent, the mainstream Democratic Party.
Harper's wonderfully unique position.
I'm not at all. And you saw in the case of the New Yorker where they invited, David Remnick invited Bannon to speak and then canceled the invitation because the Twitter sphere went crazy and his staff went crazy on him. It's not left or right, it's just social. His social status was threatened. And he was financially threatened because they also said, we won't participate or we won't buy tickets to the New Yorker Festival, which I gather they make a lot of money on. But Remnick has always been, as a friend of mine puts it, on the cutting edge of consensus. So I'm not surprised by his behavior. I am more concerned about the general unwillingness to confront the mob or to defend the idea of dissent. I mean, my God, we published a piece a couple of years ago by a convicted murderer reflecting on what it's like to spend his umpteenth year in maximum security jail for a crime he committed 25 years ago. Nobody said, how dare you publish a piece by a convicted murderer?
Yes.
Everybody questions our decision to publish a piece by John Hockenberry, who was a very... very respected journalist, and as I point out, overcame a terrible disability to do what he did in life. I mean, he deserves a little bit more of a break than he's getting. I'm astonished. And the second thing I would say to my fellow publishers is, everybody in publishing who's been in publishing knows that if you give in on libel, on intimidation, on boycott threats, it will encourage other people, other mobs, to do the same thing to you. So I don't understand the strategy. If Ray Hederman, the owner of the New York Review, thinks that he's going to appease the mob by getting rid of Baruma, he's sadly mistaken. It's only going to weaken the New York Review of Books, and it's only going to make it more difficult for the magazine to survive in very difficult times, difficult economic times.
But it does seem to be something particular about Toby Young on our USA website yesterday called it, you know, sexual McCarthyism. It's something about sexual stuff that seems to be so powerful at the moment. I mean, you know, The Guardian published Osama bin Laden when he was alive. And you know, I think they'd probably do the same now.
Yes.
But they wouldn't publish Harvey Weinstein.
Absolutely. And I don't know about The Guardian. I sometimes wonder if The Guardian isn't secretly an American publication. But there is something in this country which is puritanical beyond anything you see in other Western countries. And you have to look back at the history of the country. I mean, think about Prohibition. We prohibited the sale of alcohol for, 14 years? It was insane. Insane. Mm. The country literally tried to purge itself of alcohol, of spirits. So this country has been through other crazy attempts at self-purification before. We may be going through some new form of prohibition or something related to it. I've got to think about it more. But I do think there's something uniquely American going back to the Plymouth Colony and Governor Winthrop and his idea of the city on the hill and so on, shining a beacon of goodness and freedom to the rest of the world, or not freedom, but of goodness to the rest of the world, that stays with us. And we go through these periods of the McCarthy era was another one where we had to purge ourselves of any communist or left-wing leanings because of the New Deal. Maybe we have to purge ourselves of sexual impulses because of the liberalization of sex in the 60s and 70s. So, and again, I having published many, many distinguished feminist writers, I'm astonished by what's going on. Really astonished.
Well, actually,
it has to be resisted.
I mean, I'd like to talk a little bit about your experience. I quite understand if I'm being indelicate, but I mean, because something that interests me is that quite often it seems to be institutional. So the publication experience, you know, members of staff saying, oh, actually, I don't think this is acceptable. And there becomes this sort of, the institution turns on itself in a way. Is that something that happens in all of these instances?
Well, it varies from culture to culture. Obviously, the New Yorker, the staff or maybe management took over and told Remnick, get rid of Bannon, and Remnick complied. But there is, I suppose you could say, if you want to go deeper into it, there is a new hatred of hierarchy, which is very much a part of the internet culture. The internet, Twitter, Facebook, all these things are supposed to democratize the media and eliminate old-fashioned hierarchy where somebody at the top, the editor in my case is a woman, but she is white. Right. I do have a white woman as editor of Harper's Magazine, dictating taste and standards. Right. This is something people, the younger generation, seems to object to tremendously. They despise the idea that somebody older or more experienced or maybe even smarter would know better than they. So there is an attempt to level the playing field, so to speak, and democratize things. And I have heard that Buruma, who's written for Harper's, by the way, over the years, he's been a regular contributor to Harper's Magazine, was trying to democratize New York Review somewhat. In other words, he was more willing to listen to the staff than Robert Silvers, the legendary founder of the magazine, who really ran it the way he saw fit and did everything. He was kind of the dictator. Yeah. So yeah. Buruma tries to democratize it or open it up in the spirit of the times. And this is the price he pays for it, to some extent.
Well, yeah, that's like de Tocqueville, isn't it? You give people a little bit and they destroy you.
Well, de Tocqueville, I've read de Tocqueville thoroughly in French and in English to make sure that they didn't mistranslate him. And the remarkable thing Tocqueville noticed about America was, yes, you have the freedom to do and say pretty much anything you want, but if you do it, you are very quickly sent to the margins of society, which is where you will spend the rest of your days. And so I'm glad you brought that up because Gomeshi and although he's Canadian, but a lot of the Me Too predators, including my writer Hockenberry, have been banished to the margins of society. Nobody's saying they should go to jail, but they're saying they really shouldn't be able to function or rehabilitate themselves or work in the anything remotely connected to the jobs they used to hold.
Yes. There's also a sort of mental health argument that comes in that it's sort of damaging. It could be damaging for people to read that or to be exposed to their having a voice.
I thought the difference between the United States and North Korea was presumably it's more fun to live in the United States than in North Korea because we're allowed to have arguments and mix it up and disagree and hate each other and so on, but nobody gets hurt. In North Korea, of course, you get hurt if you try to do that sort of thing. So I'm very, very shocked. I don't want to leave out the details.
Are coming to get you, Rick.
Sorry, yeah. I'm not forgetting. You can hear it in the background. Don't forget that New York Review has now posted a kind of explanatory, apologetic introduction to the Gomeshi piece so that you're not injured by it when you read it. You're not taken by surprise. And The Nation, left-wing weekly of long standing, recently published an apology for publishing a poem which they said wasn't sufficiently respectful or sympathetic to minorities, I think, something like that. It's just crazy, just absolutely mad what's going on.
It's interesting what you said about the resistance to authority within these institutions, but then there's also, paradoxically, there is a sort of desperation for some adult to come along and stop these people from being able to talk. You know, there's a kind of, it's both democratic and authoritarian.
Yes, and the odd thing is I haven't yet encountered a Me Too authority figure. In other words, somebody who speaks for the movement. There may be some. But of course, there are a lot of women who ridicule this. I mean, my office, I'm sure, is divided in its opinion about the piece, but we're always divided in what we publish. I don't agree with everything we publish. I sometimes don't advertise it, but I've disliked pieces we've published and thought they shouldn't have been published. But it would be a very dull magazine if everybody agreed on everything that was published. Or if I liked everything that was published. It's just so stultifyingly dull. But in terms of finding an authority figure, yes, I'm the authority figure in this case, and I suppose that's why some of the hate was directed at me on Twitter. I'm not on social media, so I don't pay attention to it. But there was a lot of hate Twitter aimed at me a couple of days ago after my Canadian Broadcasting Corporation interview. But I'm very happy. I stand by the interview, and I hope people will listen to it online as well as listen to this online. And I'll also say something which I've said to some of my, because I am very much on the left. In other words, I'm on the traditional left. I favor a big welfare state. I favor national health insurance. I favor a smaller military budget, things like that. And I say to my left-wing friends, the place to find support now more and more is on the right. In other words, you need to make common cause, even if you disagree profoundly with right-wing dogma or right-wing ideology. There is an area now to make common cause with the right. They flinch. They don't want to hear it.
Yes.
I write for The Spectator, as you know. I mean, I keep telling people you don't have to sign a loyalty oath to read or write for Harper's Magazine. Same goes for The Spectator. It's anathema to me. And you say this to people, and they just become more hysterical. And again, my fellow lefty liberals don't want to hear that either. Oh, no, I don't want to be associated with anything right-wing. I don't want to go on Fox News. I've been on Fox News many times, and I, you know, do the best I can.
Well, that's another thing I think you mentioned earlier about how it's a status thing. I mean, with Remnick, perhaps that was the case, or with The New Yorker, certainly that's the case. It's almost a social acceptability thing.
Yes.
You define your politics by what will be acceptable at the parties that you want to go to.
Absolutely. And if that's the kind of party you want to go to, those are the sort of social circles you want to be in, it sounds like you're going to live a very dull life. But let's not again underplay the economic pressure. Remnick caved in because real money was in part because real money was at stake, and part because his social status was threatened. And I think the New York Review caved in for a combination of reasons, probably economic pressure and dissent within the magazine, and also maybe a threat to the social status of the owner. I'm not sure. I've tried to speak to him. I've called him a couple of times, and he doesn't return my phone calls. I tried to buck him up, actually. I wanted to buck him up and tell him, for God's sake, don't give in to these people. But yes, he hasn't returned my calls, Ray Hederman.
Well, I mean, what do you think is going to happen next then? Is this just going to get worse and worse and worse until sort of all opinion journalism on a lot of interesting subjects is pretty much unreadable?
Well,
or do you think there's a resistance within it, a resistance emerging?
That's a very good question, because I flattered myself when we published the Katie Royfe piece back in February, which started this, set off an uproar of greater proportion than what we're going through right now with Hockenberry.
Can you just in case some of our listeners don't know, can you just give us a quick summary of the Katie Royfe?
Yes, Katie Royfe, a woman on our staff said, you know, we really ought to get something in the magazine that's contrarian, that challenges the orthodoxy of Me Too. Yes, we all want to see sexual harassment opposed, and so on and so forth. In fact, Harper's, we fired a guy years ago, 9 years ago, I think, for sexual harassment. And, you know, it's just, we try to run the office for adults, and if somebody behaves childishly, they're gone, they're out. But Royfe, somebody on our staff, a woman again, wanted to publish something contrarian. So we cast around and found that some women were interested but were afraid to write this. And Katie, having been through her own Calvary 20 years earlier for a book she wrote about rape and campus sex, she was up for it. She did the piece. And instantly it was leaked because our fact checker called someone named Moira Donegan to find out if she was the author of the so-called shitty media men's list, which was the just a vile document that lumped together again people who were accused or even had admitted to physical sexual assault, and people who, in the case of one guy I know, was accused of leering at women, L-E-E-R-I-N-G. Just insane. And so the Twitter sphere went mad, and they called for boycotts against us and said people should withdraw their writing, advertisers should boycott us, before the piece had even been edited and printed. So we had to withstand that storm. But once it came out, Roifey got on national television. She got a lot of publicity. The piece was widely read, widely discussed. Many people disliked it. Some people liked it. I thought it was going to turn the tide, that it was going to reinforce the people who know that what's going on is not good for American society or democracy. But it does seem to be getting worse. I was flattering myself. And I suspect it may get even worse because of Buruma. Because again, once you give in to the bullies, they'll come back and bully you again, and they'll demand more. They'll try to extract more.
Rick, I think we'll end it there. Thank you so much for talking to us, and all the best.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for listening. Just a reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and you can also subscribe to the magazine through our special podcast offer, which is on www.spectator.co.uk/podoffer, and we'll even throw in a Spectator Moleskine notebook for people who take up that offer.